Support comes from Aventiv Research. People who are 18 or older and haven't had a pneumococcal vaccine may qualify to participate in a clinical study to evaluate if an investigational vaccine helps to protect against pneumococcal disease. Learn more at AventivResearch.com.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Nutrition fact labels are familiar on processed food boxes and other packaging. Consumers soon will get a similar score for their smart devices, denoting, among other things, how their data will be used and by whom. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon University have been exploring the idea since 2018, and now they have support from the White House. Yuvraj Agarwal is an associate professor of computer science and director of the Synergy Labs at Carnegie Mellon University. Last month, he presented the latest labeling strategy at a White House security summit. Yuvraj, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Anne.
Some of us may have heard the term, but what does Internet of Things mean? Let's kind of set the groundwork here and define these things.
So Internet of Things is one of those most overloaded terms, but the way I think about it and what most consumers should be aware of are devices that you might be bringing into your home that are connected to the internet, right, to provide smart functionality, right? Like, so that would mean a smart smoke detector, a smart fridge, your Nest, your Alexa devices, anything that is sort of internet connected and makes your home or building smarter, right? Like, so for consumer facing products, that's what I would think is what Internet of Things entails.
And how prevalent is it now? Is there any, do we have a thumbnail on that?
So I think if you believe many of the Gartner reports, they think that there'll be, you know, tens and or to hundreds of billions of connected devices on the network. I think it is quite prevalent and it has been rising. The use of it, a lot of it has been driven by sort of the voice assistants, Alexa, Google Home, and Siri. But I think more and more, it has become more and more common that people have at least connected smart lights and connected sort of other products in their home, right? So I think, I would care to venture that if people go and buy new appliances now, it's even more likely that they will be connected, right? Like, and they'll have some smart functionality.
Like a TV screen on your refrigerator kind
yes.
of thing. And because of that, because it's so ubiquitous or becoming ubiquitous, that's when we kind of let down our guard, right? We just think, well, it's everywhere. What difference does it make?
Yes, that's exactly right. Like if your fridge is not the traditional older fridge, we didn't have any connectivity, and now your fridge has a microphone, has a camera, has a display, your TV has ability for you to speak to it to change channels, which means that it actually comes with several sensors that that consumers should be aware of and that also understand the implications of it, right? Like we aren't used to bringing in microphones and cameras and putting them into our private spaces before sort of this new world that we live in. And I think many consumers are often unaware of the potential implications of these things, or if they are even aware of it, they don't know what sort of control they might have, where their data is going, how it's being used. So I think we're in a new world where, you know, our homes and our spaces around us that we use often will be sensorized with more and more devices. And it started with the smartphone, right? Your smartphone has many of these sensors already, but now the same sort of sensors are going to be coming in our homes and in our devices all around us.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Yuvraj Agarwal. He is an associate professor of computer science and director of Synergy Labs at Carnegie Mellon University. Last month, he presented a labeling strategy at a White House security summit, and not just a labeling strategy for, you know, big techies, but for everyday people buying smart any kind of smart device, from your phone to your smart doorbell. You know, I was kind of surprised when I looked at the proposed privacy labels. They do, in a way, reflect or look a lot like the kind of labels you see on your food. And I was wondering if that inspired or influenced what you were doing with this.
Absolutely. So my colleagues at Carnegie Mellon and I have been sort of working on this idea of familiar ways to represent data practices and security issues for devices and all sorts of other contexts, including mobile apps, in a way that consumers will understand it. Like, look, the fact is that devices do have a privacy policy with them, attached to them, except it's 50 pages of text that nobody uses or nobody reads, let alone understand it.
Right.
It's not really meant for consumers.
Yeah.
It's not meant to educate consumers, I'd care to venture very clearly, right? It's written in legalese. And the reason why we picked this familiar idea of a nutrition label is that people over the last few decades are familiar with what these labels look like. They may not know, sort of not everybody's born with knowing that what cholesterol is bad versus protein is good, but over time we have become attuned to the fact of zooming in to a food nutrition label and looking at the things that are important and being able to do comparison shopping amongst them, even at a glance. And that is the sort of similar idea we wanted to use for IoT devices, right? To surface these things so that consumers can use them while they are purchasing sort of their next products and choosing product A versus product B, right? So not just based on its features, but also its security and privacy attributes.
It was interesting. The example I saw was for a smart video doorbell, and you use icons because that's what we kind of are familiar with in the Internet of Things and in technology now. Icons help us. They're familiar.
Yes, exactly, right? Like, so, we realize that consumers have sort of it's a wide spectrum in terms of their technical prowess or even their interest or their level of concerns, right? It was hard, challenging for us to design something that was meant for average consumers, right? For everybody. And then the people who would just want to, look at and get a mark saying, yes, this device is verified by somebody to be secure might be enough, right? But certain other people might want to dig deeper into saying, how do you use my data? Do you use it to monetize? Who do you sell my data to, right? That might factor into their decision process. And hence our design takes that into account by making it layered so that there is a layer one, which is the most salient features and the most salient security and privacy attributes. And then if you click a QR code, it takes you to an online version that has even more extensive features. And these are all solicited by talking to a number of security and privacy experts and figuring out with them in a very carefully designed study of what should go on a label, what should the attributes look like, and whether consumers will actually understand them.
Well, and I keep going back to the parallel universe of food labels. When those first came out, a lot of people didn't understand how to read them. For instance, people say like me would go immediately to the fat column and look at, fats and percentage of fats and whatnot, or what does recommended daily mean and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering, how do you see this? This has not been unveiled yet, but when it is, that there's going to be a learning curve for people about what matters to them and how to understand what matters to them and why they should care.
I think you hit the nail on the head, right? Like, so any effort like this has to be sort of bolstered by a sustained consumer education campaign that tells consumers and educates them about what to look for and what not to look for. We're not all born to think about security and privacy. I think recently, many high-profile incidents have made people more aware. But there is possibility that many people don't know that they should be concerned about their privacy. So whether it was Energy Star for when you were buying sort of an appliance, or as you said, food nutrition labels, most people don't realize that they were sustained by significant consumer education campaigns to educate consumers about what they should look for or not. And that will be absolutely essential, even for a national label or a national mark, right? Like whenever that comes.
And I guess that's what's so important about having the White House buy in on this.
Yes, absolutely. We were like the summit last month was really great because it showed that their level of commitment on it. They've really realized that, you know, this, you know, even in during my briefing, I mentioned it's an idea whose time has come. You know, like we proposed nutrition label type things for mobile apps about 7 or 8 years ago. And you see now Apple and iOS, Apple and Google doing that. So, and one of my comments during the summit was that I hope that we won't come back in a few years as, oh, we should really have done something about this before IoT became even more pervasive, right? Like we have an opportunity. We've got sort of lots of research that we can build upon to really help consumers.
And so there is buy-in by the big tech companies too, and they're comfortable with having a nationalized or, you know, a common template.
So I think that there were big tech representatives at the summit, right? Like from all the names that you would think about, Amazon, Google, and in fact, many sort of government agencies, basically the agency that would have, that would be responsible for sort of enforcement about this, right? And including a senator. So I think the overall point was that the White House seems very serious about how to sort of like roll out a national label, but you know, we're still figuring out the details with them, right? We've been in touch with NIST, mm-hmm. we've been in touch with some of the other parties. And I think the tech companies are also realizing that this is important because many other countries in the world are already rolling out some form of labels. The EU, of course, is sort of often a step ahead in right. some of these things, whether it comes to security and privacy. So is Singapore, Finland, many of these countries are already doing that. So if nothing else, the companies in America are also realizing that in order to be truly competitive at a global scale, we need something that is harmonized and a uniform thing so that it doesn't become a burden for them to deal with different countries and their requirements.
So a couple questions on that score. What did you learn from what other companies have done?
So I think that so some companies, you know, and I even mentioned this in my talk. So the larger companies, think Amazon and Google, right? Like a few years ago, we wouldn't even see, you know, security and privacy information necessarily surface in the front, right? If you went to an Amazon storefront and tried to buy a smart video doorbell, it would tell you about the color and the size and the features, but not really about security and privacy. I think some parts of it have changed. So if you go now out to Google or Amazon's website and for their products, so the Amazon Ring, right? Like, or Amazon Echo device, they do have some information about security and privacy, right? Arguably, it's not as detailed as what we have, but the challenge is that it is still custom. The terms aren't standardized across multiple devices. Okay. You have to go to their website to find it. But, and these are only done by really big box, big retailers and big companies, right? Like, and most of the IoT products are actually, like, there's a long tail in the number of IoT devices that you get. And if you look at their products advertised on websites or even stores, you don't find any of this information. So in a nutshell, larger companies are doing something about it, but it is not standardized so that you can actually compare products, right? I think that is what our label is meant to do.
Even if everybody says, yeah, we think this is a great idea, there's still going to have to be a law.
Yes, you know, we all dislike the term regulation. So I think, but I will tell you that whether adoption needs to be voluntary or mandatory is going to be an important decision to make. And our latest research actually shows something very interesting that promotes the idea that it has to be mandatory or something that is like required, because what we found out was when consumers were given labels with good security and privacy practices and compared that to a device with bad security privacy practices, they preferred the good product and they were willing to pay significant premium for these devices, right? Like basically telling manufacturers that, you know, like this, the often excuse that you get is nobody wants to pay for it. We're like, no, based on our carefully designed consumer surveys, they want to pay for it. But if you compare a good security privacy product with an unknown, they prefer the good product. But if you compare a product with bad security and privacy factors versus one with good, with unknown, they actually prefer the unknown because they give it the benefit of the doubt, saying that it probably is not as bad as I think it is, which basically nails the point that there is very little incentive for bad actors to actually adopt something like this voluntarily, which means that it has to be something that is sort of mandatory, or at least part of the requirement is mandatory in order to gain consumer confidence, right? Because if the people with bad security privacy decide just to not show the label, mm-hmm. it's not helping consumers.
And will it be, are you thinking that where the label is posted is going to be, there's going to be a specific place? You won't have to search through a bunch of, it'll be on the box, on the outside before you ever buy it.
So that is what we sort of prototype, right? Like, but again, remember, retailers and manufacturers say that there is very little real estate on the box, right? So one of the things that we've been thinking about is it should be available, but whether it's a point of sale at the thing, it should have at least something that looks like a layer zero, which is a mark, but with a QR code where the consumer can actually click and go. But we have to realize that many consumers may not ever click and go through those QR codes. So whatever is on the box or on an Amazon storefront, when you see images, one of the images should be the label, right? Or a picture of the label, so that as we're thinking about different things about the product, it also includes things about its security and privacy practices. So I think it has to be front and center and easily accessible.
The White House said they're planning a targeted rollout of cybersecurity labels for spring 2023, which seems like tomorrow, practically. That's coming fast.
Yeah, so we were also surprised. Yeah, when Ann Newberg mentioned that, like, we were also like, oh, that's great, right? Like, the White House thinks that, you know, they want to do this soon rather than later. Sometimes I always say in research, like, you know, perfect is the enemy of the good.
Yeah.
Like in this case, it might be that, you know, like, and part of it might be, I'm hoping that all the research that we presented, actually, we got a comment during our presentation, actually a few, that they felt that we were further along than they thought, which means that they can, there's a lot of research that can actually be leveraged so that we're not starting from scratch saying what should be on the label. And there's plenty of research that we have done to show what should be on it. I feel like that is a wonderful goal, which may help accelerate some of these and actually get us to sort of actionable outcomes. So I'm looking forward to see how the next 3-4 months go. And we've been actually talking to various trade organizations as well as who's talking to other people to offer whatever we can do to help, right? All of our research, our label, our specification is all open source. We're, you know, as true academics, and this is all supported by my colleagues and the SciLab Institute, we made everything available for free so that other people can adopt it. Again, to make sure that this idea does see the light of the day.
Yuvraj Agarwal, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I invite everyone to go to iotsecurityprivacy.org and see what a label looks like and hope that maybe your next product has it when you go to, you know, by spring.
iotsecurity.org.
iotsecurityprivacy.org.
Okay, iotsecurityprivacy.org. We'll put that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Yuvraj Agarwal is an associate professor of computer science and the director of Synergy Labs at Carnegie Mellon University. Last month, he presented the latest labeling strategy for the Internet of Things, everything from your phone to your doorbell, at a White House Security Summit, and I hope we'd have them back when they do start rolling this stuff out to see how people are responding to it and see what you think. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Taylor Swift's upcoming tour was expected to break records, but when tickets for the 52-show road trip went on sale last week, the demand apparently broke the server and had lawmakers and consumer advocates up in arms against Ticketmaster. The problem is Ticketmaster's virtual monopoly on ticket sales for live events, especially since the company's 2010 merger with Live Nation. Ticketmaster controls the ticketing market, and Live Nation represents artists, owns venues, and promotes shows. The meltdown has politicians calling for a Department of Justice investigation of the debacle and critics calling for the merger to be reversed. Morgan Harper has been leading the Breakup Ticketmaster Coalition. She's director of policy and advocacy at the American Economic Liberties Project. That's a nonprofit organization advocating for corporate accountability, legislation, and enforcement of antitrust regulations. Morgan Harper, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
What's the problem with Ticketmaster? What does the fact that it's practically a monopoly have to do with the meltdown over the Taylor Swift ticket sales?
Yeah, so, you know, like you said, the organization I work for, American Economic Liberties Project, focuses on monopolies across the economy, of which there are many. And what you see with monopolies is that there tends to be a lack of investment in technology. There tends to be not a great focus on customer service, in addition to trying to extract as much money as possible from these services. And so Live Nation Ticketmaster is an example of that. Certainly there was no surprise that there was going to be a lot of demand for Taylor Swift tickets. But what we really can see from this debacle is just some of the larger harms that are coming from this monopoly as well, that are not just to fans in the form of huge fees that sometimes are 78% of the face value of tickets, but also to a lot of independent venues, independent promoters, and workers in the live events industry as well.
The merger in 2010, it happened, I don't even know if I even paid any attention to it. We kind of grew up being taught that they break up monopolies in this country. They don't let them form like this. What happened then?
That's exactly right, Anne. I mean, we have a pretty robust history in the United States of what are called trust busters and government really intervening when it seemed like companies were getting too powerful and stomping out competitions, making it harder for small businesses to compete. What happened was a different ideology developed and emerged in the 70s or so that said, you know, this consumer welfare standard, as long as prices are staying low and efficiencies are increasing, then all is well. And we're going to continue to, let combinations and mergers proceed. And a lot of those decisions and that change of ideology was set through judicial precedent, judges making decisions that then crafted changes in the law, even if the actual laws on the books that had been passed by Congress were embodying that spirit of trust busting. And so, you know, it really is actually not very out of the ordinary that in 2010, that Department of Justice Antitrust Division, which is one of the two main agencies at the federal level that has jurisdiction over a lot of monopoly and competition policy issues, greenlit this merger. And, you know, there was a consent decree that was negotiated, but all that was asked for there are what are known as behavioral remedies, more or less, saying, you know, if you need to pinky swear promise that you're not going to be anti-competitive, that you're going to be amassing, you know, this huge power as two joined companies. And that was pretty standard, but we're in a new era now. President Biden has appointed different leadership to the Department of Justice Antitrust Division. Jonathan Cantor is the leader there now, and he's really coming in with the spirit of reinvigorating antitrust enforcement at the federal level.
How soon after the merger in 2010 did the consequences of that start to emerge? The deleterious consequences to the everyday consumer.
Well, that's what's wild is they were so obvious to everyday consumers, to folks in the live events industry before the merger. And, you know, the Swifty debacle of this past week is the latest example. But as early as the 1990s, I don't know if folks remember Pearl Jam. I definitely do. And, you know, in the 1990s, they were speaking out about Ticketmaster as an individual company. But especially leading up to the 2010 merger, Bruce Springsteen was speaking out about that. A lot of people were sounding the alarm, sitting members of Congress as well. And so, you know, what happened, though, after Live Nation and Ticketmaster joined, and you identified some of the business lines that they control in the introduction, mm-hmm. concert and tour promotion, owning venues directly, artist management, and ticketing
services. Kind of a whole vertical, the whole vertical span of the industry.
Yeah, complete vertical integration equals game over, not just for consumers and these higher fees, but in some ways even more impactful is just, you know, how independent venues have been hurt by this, and artists themselves, even artists, you know, like global superstars, Taylor Swift, who are undoubtedly making a lot of money, you know, with their tours and the current situation. We don't, one, know what they're giving up in terms of the revenue that a lot of these tours are generating. And then if you're an artist that's even a little bit below that level of global superstar stardom, good luck. trying to earn enough money to make it worth your while.
Oh, really? So they're not getting much of a cut at all then?
Well, all of these contracts are private. So only if artists are willing to speak out and disclose what the terms are would we know for sure. But in a lot of the conversations that we've been having with people, you know, what Ticketmaster Live Nation is able to do is say, you know, to the big time artists, and they have a lot of them under, you know, their contracts, okay, you're going to be able to get a very high percentage of the ticketing revenue, for example, but you need to come to only our venues, right? You got to play by our rules. And so if you break this down, some tours, you'll start to see that some cities are skipped if there isn't a Live Nation venue in a certain location. Or if they are going to non-Live Nation venues, it might be on, you know, a Tuesday or Wednesday tour stop day rather than Friday and Saturday where you can make even more money.
Is Columbus an example of one of those places?
So I am not totally sure on all the ownership mechanisms in Columbus. It would be good to hear from people that are in the industry in Columbus. Taylor Swift's not coming to Columbus, so that might
right.
be
right. That's why I wonder. And a lot of big, well, a lot of biggies overlook Columbus because our venues tend to be like the Shot and those kind of places, not privately owned venues that may be associated with live.
Yeah, yeah, and the economics of it have just become really complicated for if you are trying to be, you know, more independent. So, yeah, there's so many harms here. The ticket prices are just one example of it. But at the end of the day, what it comes down to is there is this vertical integration. There is this monopoly power that Live Nation Ticketmaster is exerting over the industry. And unless we break them up, we're not really going to see any changes, only increasing harm. So that's why we launched this coalition, Break Up Ticketmaster, a month ago. And there are a lot of different, you know, types of organizations that are a part of it. And we've already seen over 45,000 people send letters to the Department of Justice saying, we need to do something about this, break them up.
You know, you're also a politician. You ran for the primary for the U.S. Senate this past year. It's fair to ask, is this a partisan issue right now? Because the only politicians I've seen speaking out against the merger or at least speaking for an investigation are Democrats.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's interesting I think it's right that so far on this particular issue, there have only been a lot of Democrats speaking out on it, but there is a range of Democrats that are talking about it. And so, you know, Senator Amy Klobuchar has been a very outspoken critic of Live Nation Ticketmaster for some time. Senator Blumenthal, actually just yesterday, Klobuchar, Blumenthal, and Markey sent a letter to the Department of Justice saying that they need to consider, you know, structural solutions here. And but I would say that on antitrust and anti-monopoly issues generally, it is one of the few areas in Washington right now that is bipartisan. And if you look at, you know, another fight, big tech, Facebook, Google, there are a lot of Republicans that are supporting that. And you know, what I'm always trying to encourage people to do in both of my hats and worlds is look beyond the politicians and let's talk to the people. And at the ground level, I would say that this is extremely bipartisan in terms of folks on the ground realizing that, hey, something's off here. I used to have a lot more, you know, small businesses in my community, the east side of Columbus where I grew up. Used to have a lot more independent grocery stores, for example. Those are all gone. Big box retail after big box retailer. What has changed? Well, what's changed is lax antitrust enforcement over the past 40 years that have resulted in extreme concentration of economic power. And anybody can look around, you know, different parts of Ohio and see the results of that.
And I'm fascinated by the price of tickets. Frankly, I mean, I don't even know how people afford them anymore. It's like the big Christmas present for a lot of kids, but that would be a really big Christmas present to go to a Taylor Swift concert.
Have an extra $100,000 on hand?
It's crazy, but it's really nuts. And Ticketmaster seems to also be benefiting from ticket scalping. Do you know how that works?
So, you know, there's a primary ticketing market, which is when the tickets initially go on sale. And then there's also the secondary market where there's the resale. Resale is very controversial. I mean, a lot of artists don't like the existence of resale at all. And Ticketmaster is dipping in both of those revenue pools.
But are they supposed to be, or isn't there some kind of, aren't they supposed to not be doing that?
Yeah. So right now they're doing whatever they want. And that's another key thing to note about a monopolist is monopolists don't have to play by anybody's rules but their own, because they know that at this point, given the level of concentration, there are no choices. So, you know, another example of how that plays out in the Live Nation Ticketmaster example is, so if an artist wanted, you know, this was interesting actually with this whole Taylor Swift saga, because if you saw the interview where, so the chairman of Live Nation Ticketmaster board did an interview last week. They were having an investor meeting and he was asked about all that had happened with the ticket sales. And his response was kind of blaming Taylor Swift, but also saying, you know, they have a choice to make, and they decided to go with us, with Ticketmaster, for to be the ticketing service for their tour, because they know that we're the best, that we're great. And actually Taylor Swift's promoter came back, AEG, and said, we don't have any choices, right? So, you know, even if we wanted something different, it doesn't exist. And so the fact that so many tours are using Ticketmaster is not a reflection. And this is really important, because this would be one of the talking points from Live Nation Ticketmaster, that they're just great. It's not that they're so great. It's that they have stomped out the rest of competition in the market through aggressive serial acquisitions. And so now people have to play with them, or they are not going to make any money off of live events at all. And that's a real problem. And that's exactly why, again, you know, we need to have the Department of Justice impose structural solutions here.
And people can't believe when they go on to buy the tickets, people were waiting hours. I read stories about how people were waiting all day on the phone and kept getting bumped off, or online, I should say, kept getting bumped off, knocked off, waiting after maybe 2 hours, getting a bump off, having to go back, re-up themselves. And you would think that the technology would be there. Are these concerts at all getting too big for the technology? Or does it go back to what your first assertion was, is that they don't invest in technology because they don't have to?
I think it's partly that they don't necessarily have to make great improvements because they know there's nowhere else to go. But then there's also another thing to keep in mind. If there were a more competitive marketplace with different venues using different ticketing services, and there have been different ticketing services that existed, then there wouldn't be all of this demand going to one platform. And so even though the centralized platform benefits Live Nation Ticketmaster, it's the reason why they can pay their CEO tens of millions of dollars, it's not actually benefiting the customer experience. And so, you know, what a world after breaking up Ticketmaster would look like, which is a common question we get, It would look like you don't always use Ticketmaster. And so we don't have 2 million fans going to the exact same site. We might have, you know, 20% of fans going to Ticketmaster, and then the rest would be spread throughout other competitors in the market.
And those competitors would be incentivized to provide, you know, the incentive would be, the competition would be at the service and customer service level, not at the this is all you have to work with level.
Exactly. Exactly. Sounds great, right? Sounds a little bit like what maybe we had in the 1980s.
Yeah, in the olden days. And I also wonder, would the prices go down, though, if there was more competition?
Well, we potentially would also see the prices go down. And so, you know, like I was saying, at this point, there are sometimes 78% of ticket price that is being charged in additional fees. What are these fees? Some labels get placed on them, like service fees or, you know, facility fees, all these. We don't have transparency in what these fees are for. And this is another initiative from the Biden administration to overall across the economy, identify these junk fees that companies are imposing because they can, not because they're really providing any additional service, and get rid of them. And so, yeah, if Ticketmaster, Live Nation knew that they were up against very strong competitors, well, then prices would actually potentially come down. And I think that's another interesting thing here, because like we were discussing, a lot of the justification for lax antitrust enforcement over my entire lifetime has been this consumer welfare standard, prices staying low. But even if you apply that failed standard to this example, it's not true, because as we're seeing, prices are going through the roof.
Morgan Harper, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here, Ann.
Morgan Harper is Director of Policy and Advocacy at the American Economic Liberties Project. It's a nonprofit advocating for antitrust regulations. She's also a former U.S. Senate candidate for Ohio at the primary level, and she's been leading the Breakup Ticketmaster Coalition. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Bye. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. An artificial intelligence tool developed by Meta AI, that is, you know, Facebook, has not gone well. And the 2022 holiday season kicks off this week with Black Friday. But some of the best deals are already available, as usual these days. Here to tell us more is Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell. Hello, Russell.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, the Meta story, that Meta AI thing is just a, what a debacle.
Yeah, so the whole goal here, this entire, it's really bad. Facebook had been working for a couple of years now on building something that could read hundreds of thousands of medical journals and kind of professional websites full of information in order to create this sort of like an AI-powered advanced search engine for like complicated topics like quantum computing and how vaccines are being developed and, you know, kind of the underlying technology behind all of those things in order to make it easier for any kind of person to kind of understand the basics of those things. It was available for 48 hours in a demo form before it was so relentlessly mocked for giving just flat wrong information that it was pulled, and there is no set date for when it will return.
It was a classic Facebook scenario, go fast and break things or something like that. Move
this
fast.
So this is actually not, Facebook is not the first company to try this. Microsoft has tried similar versions of, you know, let's have an artificial intelligence scan the internet and read all of the comments and then build a personality based on that. And it turned out that personality was terribly racist. Every time that we have one of these large companies that has decided that they're going to give this artificial intelligence access to this massive wealth of data, the end result is not this grand all-knowing thing. And it's the weird thing isn't that it has happened. The weird thing is that it continues to happen, that there are no like safeguards in place to stop this sort of thing from happening.
They called it Galactica, which I think is interesting.
They did call it Galactica. A lot of things like this have, you know, kind of these really weird names that aren't supposed to leave like the developer area, and then when they get turned into real products, they get the kind of professional name that goes along with it. You see this with movies too, in order to kind of obscure what the name of the thing is. But they decided to call it Galactica. It was it was something where you should have been able to ask pretty standard questions. And the results were just not great at all.
The worry is, I mean, what have we learned from this? I mean, what's the lesson here?
The lesson here is that it is extremely difficult to give any artificial intelligence access to an unfiltered kind of tube of information without any kind of guardrails for what information is deemed correct and what information is deemed incorrect. And we see versions of this that regular humans deal with all day long. If you get on a social media page, you know, what tools are available for you to determine what is accurate information and what is inaccurate information? And if you, you know, kind of filter that even further down, you know, kind of a fractured, you know, kind of global political climate where you have differences of opinion being viewed as differences of fact, that's really difficult for an artificial intelligence to kind of know the difference between. Those struggles have to exist in a place where the people writing that software have some guidelines on what is considered fact and what is considered opinion. And it doesn't seem like that was adequately in place here.
I wonder why they felt the need to have the beta be so all-encompassing at the outset. Why not limit it to like the universe of pickleball or something, you know, and kind of start out that way? I mean, if it is a beta, this is a testing thing, right? They're testing it.
So the cool thing about artificial intelligence, which is also the worst thing about artificial intelligence, is that the more information you just throw at it all at once, the more effectively it can kind of filter down that information and you can kind of build things around it in order to get the most accurate results. Having more people use it in abstract ways that you hadn't thought of as long as you haven't overpromised, you know, is actually a really good idea to train an AI model, because the AI model is learning from the people who are asking those questions. And you know, it's not so much the first question that they've asked, but the second question that they've asked, that AI system can go, oh, okay, like, these are related thoughts. Like, these are, you know, this is someone kind of going down a research rabbit hole. And so I can organize my information better in order to provide the best answer the first time, the next time somebody asks that question. You know, so it is okay. Designed to be this kind of back and forth learning experience when you're in that kind of beta environment. But that again, you know, it is built on the notion that the first answer you get is actually useful.
Yeah. And so even though people are fully aware, I mean, I'll never be a beta tester, but that people who did get in on that, they're fully aware this is a test model, but it didn't even meet that standard. I mean, as you said, they took it down after 48 hours.
They did take it down for 48 hours. To Meta's limited credit here, there was a gigantic piece of text on the page when people were using it that said, never follow the advice of a language model without verification. They knew that this information was not going to be 100% on the nose. This was entirely about learning. But the problem they ran into is that there were zero people who used this and walked away and was like, oh, I'm glad I did that.
And the large language model, what is that? And what's the connection here?
Yeah. So the kind of artificial intelligence that is being used here is called a large language model. And what that means basically is that these tools are given access to just an enormous amount of text. And video and things like that. Like, it is built on, you know, being able to summarize incredible amounts of text into, you know, boiling it down into like one or two sentences, so that you, instead of looking through 15 research papers on how quantum computing works in order to get an understanding of how that technology actually functions, the idea was to go here and say, how does quantum, you know, how do quantum computers work, and have this system take all of that massive amount of information and boil it down to like a paragraph.
Aren't there already humans that could just give me a couple graphs on how quantum physics works?
That is absolutely true. However, you know, people tend to do things like sleep and have other things going on. And so, you know, that they're not an unlimited resource to people who would ask that question just sort of casually at 2 a.m. And so the goal here is to, you know, to try and make it so that it's this democratized tool that anybody can use. And the funny thing about the sentence democratized tool that anyone can use is that it never really seems to work out that way.
So after 48 hours, Meta AI said, never mind about Galactica. When do you think it's coming back? I mean, what are the expectations going forward?
I would be surprised if we see it before. I would go ahead and say late next year. You know, there's just clearly an enormous amount of work that goes here. And at the same time, Meta, like so many other companies, is currently laying people off for, you know, kind of loss of revenue and, you know, kind of current market conditions. So even something is in, you know, Facebook has this, you know, kind of massive ethos about planning for the future and having tools set aside in order to kind of build things for the future. But even with, you know, if they're intentionally limiting resources in order to save money for the company, it's unlikely that there would be kind of an all hands on deck push to fix this.
You know, I know we have other things to talk about, but I am curious about your take on these gigantic layoffs and what you think the impact, since you deal kind of at the retail level with technology, what you think the fallout's going to be, you know, in 1 or 2 years when all these programmers have been laid off?
Yeah, I think it's there's kind of 2 points that are worth hitting on here. One is that, you know, during the pandemic, a lot of these tech companies made an enormous amount of money off of people who were sitting at home and not able to do things. And they did very little to course correct when things started to open back up. Like there was not kind of a relaxment period. There was this assumption that things like online shopping was just going to continue to be the most popular thing, you know, as far as people buying things and you know, people communicating exclusively through online tools was going to, you know, this growth was expected to continue. There was just very little data to back that up, but it was something that the entire industry leaned into, especially early pandemic, when you heard things like this is the future of work and this is the future of shopping. And it turned out that none of those things ended up being the immediate future. As soon as doors opened back up into stores and things like that, people started going back outside. So that's kind of the first thing. The second thing that's really important to point out here is that a lot of the folks that are being laid off here are not necessarily programmers, but support staff, okay, human resources teams, diversity groups, and things like that. In a lot of cases for these tech companies are the largest groups being impacted because they're seen as kind of conveniences and not necessarily necessary when the you know, kind of the company is trying really hard to demonstrate that it's revenue positive.
Okay. And like, how long do you think that Twitter's going to last with their particular brand of layoff craziness?
I think that even if Twitter is 12 people and three cups and strings, that it will still keep floating in some way or another, but I have no idea what that thing will look like. And I think that a lot of people use Twitter as a news feed of sorts. And as soon as it stops being reliable as that news feed, then that's when things are really going to be problematic for that organization. People who, like me, are, you know, have an addictive relationship with Twitter and are kind of constantly sharing bits and pieces of our lives, we're actually not the majority of users on Twitter. A lot of people use Twitter as a news feed, as a you know, kind of as a constant ticker of what's happening in the world. And the moment that stops being the case, that's when Twitter's in real trouble.
So back to our regularly scheduled topics. LG is turning surfaces of the car into a speaker. I'm fascinated by this, which completely makes sense. There's a speaker on my phone that sometimes works better than the one in my car.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, the concept of like thin pieces of material being added to things like glass or, you know, kind of super smooth plastic and things like that in order to turn them into speakers by sharing the vibration property, you know, with that thing and creating a big speaker is actually not a new concept. But it is, you know, limited typically to very flat surfaces. And there are a lot of rules around what, you know, generates really good sound. LG has been working really hard on these things called thin actuator sound solutions. In basically a film that you can place over things inside of the car's dashboard or kind of the instrument panel and things like that, that will excite the material there and turn it into speakers.
You say it like that's just, it seems like a miracle.
Well, so, you know, like I said, there are tiny versions of this that already exist. And the problem hasn't been like the technology has been there for a while. The problem has been the quality hasn't always been super good. You can see a lot of these, you know, place your phone on this thing and it'll turn the surface, you know, of your coffee table into a speaker. Problem is that the quality isn't usually very good. What LG is promising here is not just an improved quality of the audio, but actually a 3D sound experience. So the kind of surround sound experience that you get from very expensive car stereo systems, LG is working on you know, making it so that there's not a whole bunch of speaker grills all over your car, but in fact, the big, you know, 12-inch screen that is the instrument panel for you know, kind of the next, you know, electric car or something, that whole panel may in fact be a speaker.
Hey, it's time to kick off our annual holiday gift-giving guide, and because we always do that right before Black Friday. And the fact is like in previous years, the deals are already, they're already dealing.
Oh, man. In some cases, Amazon, I'm pretty sure, started some of its Black Friday sales a full week ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, we joke every year about Black Friday being an entire month, but I think it may actually be a full calendar month at this point. And there are just, you know, a lot of the other competing stores. Walmart just released a bunch of it deals. Mm-hmm. Target has made some similar announcements. Honestly, I, you know, having kind of waded through this for the last couple of days, we know that there's going to be a ton of, you know, kind of the bigger, more interesting deals happening either Thanksgiving evening or, you know, kind of rolling right into Friday, depending on what retailer you're working with. But I think the most interesting thing right now are seeing some of the less popular streaming services offering huge discounts for entire year subscriptions. So Paramount Plus, for example, is doing $1 a month for $12. $1 a month for 12 months for you know, an entire year of the service without ads or anything like that. Paramount Plus is doing something similar with 50% off for its entire year. And this is really interesting because we've had this conversation a couple times this year about people having kind of subscription fatigue when it comes to streaming services. That subscription fatigue kind of goes away when you know that it's a dollar for, you know, at least for someone like me, for, you know, kind of all of the Star Trek shows, especially the ones that are coming out this year. Like that's a thing that's particularly interesting.
Is there even going to be a Cyber Monday anymore, do you think? I mean, everything seems so cyber-oriented now as it is.
So we have seen in the last couple of years that there's not usually a rash of new things that are on sale for Cyber Monday. It's usually, you know, kind of there were things that were on sale on Black Friday, but they sold out maybe by like 10 a.m. or something like that. And they'll come back on Cyber Monday and they'll be like, hey, turns out we found 100 more of them in the back of the warehouse when they were really there the whole time. But it's that kind of refresh. So my advice is instead of waiting for a whole new kind of rash of deals to show up on Monday, which usually doesn't happen, if you tried to get something and it sold out, there's a reasonable chance that it will come back that Monday morning.
Russell Holly, thank you so much as always. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly is managing editor for commerce at CNET. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.